Hi, Mary. Hi, Lou. Hi, Mer. Here comes the colonel.
You know, it's beyond me. I really can't understand it. All these comedians down the hall who can't get a decent radio program of their own have to sneak in here and disrupt a serious science program. All right, welcome back to the second half hour, the promise of tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network as we explore the exciting business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. In just a minute, we're going to get back to Jack Bishop and today's exciting guest. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. That's always lots of fun. But right now, let's step over here to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set. Mess around here in the coin jar a little bit to answer today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help?
And of course, throwing in the coins always awakens the spirit of the fountain. All right, oh spirit of the fountain, you should know this one, this query, put on your thinking cap or your water cap or whatever you're putting on. But tell us, which African country borders both Lake Tanganyika and Victoria Falls? Lake Tanganyika and Victoria Falls. That'll be easy for you, old spirit of the fountain. Which African country borders them both?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell me.
The spirit of the mountain might have something in common with the African country because of the lake and the falls. All right. The African country that borders both Lake Tanganyika and Victoria Falls, all that water for the spirit of the fountain, the African country is, of course, Zambia. Yes, oh, spirit of the fountain, you guessed it. Thanks a bunch. All right, back to Jack Bishop and today's program.
There are very, very few things that get me as excited as when we start talking about a green world. And joining us today is Michael Torres. He is the CEO of Green World Restoration. And Michael, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Jack. It's an honor to be here. Appreciate it.
Now, you're pretty excited about something that you just received. And I want you to tell our audience about why you're excited.
Well, we're excited. You know, several efforts and or several years of our research and development on building materials that are resilient to the elements, to natural disasters, and you don't have to lose your green to go green. You can actually spend the same amount you spend today on regular construction materials, and we're actually starting to see an adoption at different government agencies beginning to show an interest, and so we're excited that we just received a government contract from the state of Texas, the Texas General Land Office, whereby they received $3.4 billion in funds from the federal government to rebuild homes. Half of that money is for housing, half of it's for infrastructure, as a result of natural disasters like Ike and Dolly and the Bastrop wildfires. And so this presents an opportunity to not necessarily do things the same way, but, you know, come in with different ideas. Still achieve housing the way we see housing today, culturally, and all the amenities that we enjoy, but also thinking about it in terms of materials that are better for the environment and that are built to withstand that next hurricane or fire, and you know, really working through that side of it. So we're excited about working with the state and several of the developers throughout the state.
Now, when I first came down here to Texas, one of the things that I learned early on is that the great state of Texas historically had always had a history of green building, really up until the 1950s, when Mr. Fetter said, we're just going to air condition every damn thing. And that Texans, before that, would build their homes with certain construction methods and construction planning, where a house or a building would have a airspace that would sort of cool things down a little bit. There'd be trees all around everything. And the use of water evaporators and ceiling fans. And I remember when I was a kid growing up in the Imperial Valley of California, there is nothing like sleeping under a ceiling fan. But why did we... I know we got away from that because of convenience, but why did it take so long for us to come back to seeing the importance of building green?
Well, it's great observation. I mean, it's some of it's been lost, but some of it's being regained. So a lot of the ideas from the past, you know, they're still out there for us to use. And shows that they can be done. So it's a matter of believing that we can do it. But I think the challenge has been that, you know, as we continue to grow, we've always looked for the most, cost efficient solutions and that we could rapidly develop as cities would begin to grow. And so in some of these cases, we never industrialized some of those solutions. We never brought them to market, if you will. So the opportunity exists to create, take what we know in industrial manufacturing and product delivery and bring some of these solutions to market, but keeping in mind that we still have to meet the cost parameters of what we'll, you know, that we have to spend the current amount what we're spending today or less, otherwise it's not likely there's going to be adoption, and that we are able to inform people and builders and communities that there are better ways to do it. So I think the precipitating factor that I'm seeing that's driving that shift greater than anything is the natural disasters, having to rebuild where, like Elmore, Oklahoma, there were 1,500 homes destroyed. There were 20,000 homes destroyed or damaged up in New York, New Jersey from Hurricane Sandy. And, of course, recently we just hit the Philippines. And so I think that gives us a chance to take pause and say, okay, what can we do different to make our homes more fortified, but we can also do something that's actually better for the planet as well. And so I think we're at that stage now where, you know, population density, we're up to 7 billion people. In 1830, that was the first time we hit a billion people, right when the Industrial Revolution began. And, of course, history, there's debate on how long we've been here, you know, biblically 7,000 to 8,000 years, or scientists would say that remains are loosey or 2 million years old. So it took a long time to get to a billion people, but it took less than 200 years to get to 7 billion. So we've really scaled. We've really grown, and we've had a lot of innovation. We have wireless communications and all kinds of things that just didn't exist even back in my days in high school and college. So we've really innovated very quickly. And so I think it's time to take some of those innovation skills and bring them towards sustainability. And not just being green, but being sustainable, environmentally imbalanced, both from a positive and a defensive perspective. So things that are good for the earth, but things that are resilient to earth elements. Culturally, that we still meet cultural needs of different people, and we're not trying to put everybody into a square box, if you will. And so I think it's now's the time to really look at these opportunities, and because there's challenges we're facing with the natural disasters, it will present an equal opportunity to help balance that back out.
I was listening in on somebody's conversation the other day at a restaurant, and a guy said, well, this global warming thing can't be true because look at the weather we had here in north central Texas just last week. And I got to thinking, I thought that we were winning the battle of informing people that the weather phenomena and the weather changes that we are seeing are driven by something, and that something is probably global warming. But we really haven't done a good job of linking a thing like Hurricane Katrina, a thing like the crazy weather pattern we're having now, with the fact that maybe we human beings have kind of screwed up some of the natural weather development systems. So what can we do as a better way of getting people to, like the guy I heard at the coffee shop saying, it can't be global warming because, look, it was 15 degrees in Dallas.
Right.
How can we get them to say, well, wait a minute, there's got to be something causing this? And
well, Go ahead. Well, it's interesting because it's the global warming issue is one that it's like we have duality. We have left and right. We have Republican, Democrat. We have day and night. We have male, female. And the universe we live in, there's always these different dualities. And the reality is there is some global warming, and yes, there's also elements of cooling. And everything's in balance. So when things get out of balance, one place that was once hot might get cold, and one place that was cold might get hot. So it's nature's way of continuing to balance things out. So a real simple example is Haiti. Haiti's a small microclimate. Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Haiti's on the windward side of the island, which would traditionally get more rain. The Dominican Republic's on the leeward side of the island would have less rain. It wasn't about 50 years ago that the Haitians were the rich people on the island, and the Dominican were the poor. And the reason was is they had more rain, they had more crops, they had abundant crops of sugar cane, they had the casinos, and things were going pretty good, strong agricultural society. What they didn't have is they didn't have cooking fuels, and they didn't have a policy that said you couldn't cut trees down. And so on the Dominican Republic side, they had cooking fuels, and they also had a policy that if you could cut one tree down, you have to plant two. Well, what happened in Haiti was the trees were harvested, and then all of a sudden the rain began to shift. So it was less in one place more than the other. Things were balancing out. So Haitian rainfall from the early 1900s dropped 67%, and then Dominican Republic rainfall increased by 83%. And so in that period of time, the rich became poor and the poor became rich. So even with 67% less rain in Haiti, they had major crop failure because the water would run straight from the mountaintops directly to the ocean because now it was like desert. And so any of the topsoil would be taken. And then, of course, you'd have issues with cholera where you'd have septic and waste systems now that would also flood as well. Right top. So it definitely is a balancing thing that's going on, and it's not, you know, black or white or red or yellow. It's kind of a gray, right? So it's not just global warming. It's a combination of things that are creating these imbalances. And so then what the environment's doing is it's adjusting to it. So it'd be like, you know, if we went out late one night and we had two bottles of wine and the next day we'd fill it the next day, our body would balance it out.
I see your point.
That's what we're dealing with right now.
I like that analogy. You know, as a guy who's been known to drink a bottle of beer every now and then, it's amazing how the body will balance out my ingestion of beer. Now, we talk about emerging markets, and you know, usually the guys that do reporting on economics and trade are always talking about growing emerging markets, but there's some real problems with that, and problems of sustainability and problems of expansion of some of the global warming issues, and particularly this thing about the methane levels that I've been reading about, that we're really approaching a tipping scale with that, are we not?
That's what I understand, what I've read as well.
Now, I lead with that to come to this point. We're once again talking about some kind of world treaties about some of this. And the United States has not had an exactly stellar history of participation in that. Do you think we're going to get some reevaluation of our usual policies about the connection between what we do economically and what happens with the planet's environment?
We're not there yet consciously. You know, consciousness can be at an individual level where somebody might learn in school and learn a certain aptitude relative to engineering or science. It also can be at a collective level. So a collective nation or a collective people, maybe a collective being a Texan, right? There's a consciousness around that. And the collective consciousness has not yet understood the correlation between the macro resource connection and the economics. We understand that resources have value commodities have value, we even understand that if the price of the barrel goes up by $10, it's going to impact the loaf of bread by X number of cents, if you will. What we don't understand is the macro connection between what happens when you have less water and the price of your water goes from a third of a cent to 10 cents. In Haiti, they're paying 25 cents. What happens to your grocery bill there? And then what happens when you, if you persist to have additional natural disasters and eventually your insurance market has a difficult time dealing with paying those policies out, what happens to the insurability of assets? And then what happens to the investments that are depending on those assets to have a secure investment? So those synapses, if you will, between the axons and dendrites within our brain haven't happened at a macro socioeconomic level. And what I kind of liken it to is, anybody that's gone through any kind of transformation in their life, let's say substance abuse, let's say they had an alcohol problem or, drug or eating disorder, and they visited the 12-step program. The 12-step program, step one is you have to admit you have a problem. That's the first step. And then in a lot of cases, we still are not in consensus that we even have a problem. Now, I do believe that it's becoming more apparent and that there are folks in the government that realize that we can do something about it, because we can, and we know we can. In World War II, Victory Gardens, the farmers were off to war, women were in the factories riveting, building planes and all kinds of things, and we had to have local food production. In 2 years, Victory Gardens created 40% of food production locally. So we can do it, but we just haven't gotten past that first step. And back to your earlier question, comment and question around the correlations. And so typically that alcoholic, before he goes to the rehab program, has to get to so many challenges in life, and all of a sudden goes, okay, I've got a problem, I've got to do something about it. My prayer is that we recognize it sooner than later, because then it's more graceful in how we respond to it.
And probably easier, less painful, maybe.
Now, less painful and easier, exactly.
Now, we mentioned sustainability early on in the segment we're doing, and we don't hear a lot about that. We hear about steps we can take, but I don't hear much conversation that you take the step and then you got to keep it going, because these changes in the environment happen slowly. Do we have the savvy to do that? Can we figure that out, that it's we're not going to see effects right away? It took us a long time for most of us, although just a speck of time in the overall scheme of things. But I can remember it wasn't as hot in Dallas as it is now when I came here back in 1970.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So do we have people who are able to look far enough? Do we have futurists when it comes to the world's ecology? Do we have people that look far enough ahead and say, look, you're not going to get it next year? And are we listening to them at all?
They're out there, but I don't think the voice is rising to a high enough level just yet. But I have a feeling that in the coming years they will begin to, because I think we're going to begin to ask those questions that you're asking today across a lot of different people in a lot of different communities. so I think that the solutions will come, but it's more of us accepting those. I think. And then we also, it's about prioritization as well. We're, what can we really do together across left or right, or across different nations, to make the biggest impact? And I think there's an opportunity to relook at that as well, because I know right now everything is focused on, or there's a lot of great policies out there, and there can be more, but a lot of our efforts, or that are good efforts, is reducing the gas emissions. I would actually argue that there's even a bigger opportunity, and it's about reducing the consumption of trees, which are the ones that process the gases. So there's offense and defense in all these things, right? There's both the duality, both sides of the coin, if you will. And what I would argue is that if out of the 7 billion people who are here today, back in 1830, maybe 6 or 7 of our family's generations, all of us, we were only at 1 billion people. And so out of the 7 billion people today, 2 billion of us cut trees to cook. We don't have access to cooking fuel. So it's just like Haiti, the same causality we saw in that microclimate, or that test tube of the planet, and what causality happened. And so with that thought in mind, if there's 2 billion of us that are like that are fixing to be 4 billion people, how do we address that? Because even if the richest people in the world donated all their money, Bill Gates, Carlos Slim, Warren Buffett, and said, let's go plant some trees. We're just going to be funding the cost of goods sold of 2 billion people, about to be 4 billion people. So that's not sustainable in itself. So the bigger question is, okay, how do we bring that back into balance in a way that's sustainable? And so I believe there are ways that we can work together that involve, let's say, liquid natural gas. It's a cleaner cooking fuel. It may not be as clean as solar, and we know it's not as clean as solar, but if we've got 2 billion people, about to be 4 billion people, that's kind of like the emergency room, right? What's the triage? What do we do immediately to stop that bleeding? And how do we come together to solve that problem? And then what are the longer-term strategies so that we could envision a world of 49 billion people as opposed to a world of, you know, can we make it to 8 billion? So I think because the math is such a scale as it is today, I think we actually have to be having these discussions in a positive way in developing the solution and the solution architecture to allow it to happen. So I think the minds are out there. There are solutions out there. But it's more getting it to that level of consciousness that we can do something about it. We need to do something about it, and then what we can do something about it.
Spending some time talking with Michael Torres. He's the CEO of Green World Restoration. Michael, how did Green World Restoration come about, and what are some of the things you're going to be working with as far as this this grant that you've got? You guys got a lot of money.
We it came about. My background has always been in paradigm shifts, where we believe the world was flat, and all of a sudden we found out it was round, and there's a lot of opportunity when the world's round and not just flat, right? There's a whole new world that opens up. And I was involved in helping our nation with, after 9/11, I worked with Homeland Security, TSA, in designing some of our screening and targeting systems and systems to help make our airlines safer and our borders safer, and then also began working with UK equivalents and the Australian equivalents, and became an advisor to Interpol, International Data Sharing and cybersecurity. And prior to 9/11, I really didn't have any experience in the government. My uncle worked for the government for many years up in D.C., so I'd come up and visit when I was a teenager. But it was the first time I really had a chance to really get in there and make something happen. And I really enjoyed working with the government and believe that there's some really good people in there that can do some wonderful things. It's just seeing through to find the right solutions. And here we had a paradigm shift. We went from, you know, Cold War symmetric threat versus to more of an asymmetric threat where you're dealing with, you know, smaller groups, non-state on state warfare. And how do you begin to design systems for that? Well, as time would be, down the road there, I saw an opportunity around how do we deal with this asymmetric threat of earth, water, wind, fire, with hurricanes, tornadoes, and how do we deal with that? And so that was really where the idea behind Green World was, let's design materials and solutions that help us to get in balance with the planet and to be more resilient and hardy for any of the challenges that we face. So that was the genesis of Green World. And then in terms of where we're at right now, we have a product suite. I like to look at it kind of like what Intel did with the 286 processor, 386, 486 Pentium. We came out with our suite of products, and our first product is our Innovator, which is a metal stick product, which typically would be more what we'd see like in hospitals or high-end commercial buildings. You typically don't see it in residential because it costs more, but we've been able to figure out a methodology and approach to construction that reduces time by 90% so that you can afford the same price per square foot and slightly less a recycled metal product that's 2.5 times more structural than wood. So that kind of makes it a no-brainer in terms of, making the homes more resilient at the same price. You don't have to lose your green to go green. And then our next product, our next step up is a lightweight concrete. We call it Eco Classic. That's about half the weight of normal concrete. Tested, ASTM tested up to a 350 PSF on a transverse load, which takes you up to 370 mile an hour wind load. And F5 tornadoes up to 317. And what we were getting in all of our tests were that our panels would get 1.5 inches deflection on a 370 mile an hour wind load. And then our fortress basically combines both of those products, the metal stick and the concrete, to create a double wall system and really designed if you're dealing with both seismic issues and wind issues, because it's just like our bodies, we've got bone and muscle and tendons. So you have the metal stick on the inside, you got the concrete on the out. And we have a series of other products that we bring into market as well that are even more environmental in terms of using less energy, less cement, and actually having more structural qualities to them and more energy efficiency. So that's, as a company, we really are a materials company, but we're excited to be working with the state of Texas as one of the vendors. There are several vendors that were awarded contracts to help out in providing some of these materials to make the homes more resilient and stronger, so that as we rebuild them, we're not rebuilding the same way, expecting a different result. And then we're also going to be working up in Oklahoma with some of the rebuilding up there, and we hope to be in New Jersey sometime next year as well, helping out up there as well.
Sounds like you're going to be pretty busy here. Now, we've got just a few moments left. I'm going to ask you this. Is there anything that you especially want the audience to know?
I think that to realize that while these changes are going on, that we are going to find a way to become more sustainable as a society, and that just having that confidence and knowing that we always have in the past. Look, if we go back to the 30s, we had the Great Depression. We had dust bowls. We had dirt in the air. And what a lot of people don't know is that we ran out of surface water in a lot of places. And of course, the economy was having challenges at that time too. You have a resource limitation. You're typically going to have also economic limitations. And so that we understand that resources are tied to economics, so it's that we can do both good for the environment and good for the economics, because they're linked together, and that we do find solutions, because what we found was that we could actually get to groundwater. We learned how to, because of the drilling work we were doing in the oil and gas industry, we knew how to get down to the ground, and so we get down to groundwater. And so we found a solution, a society. And we're going to be facing some more challenges, not only with housing reconstruction and things like that related to natural disasters, but we're also running low on water. A lot of the groundwater is depleted. We're going to find solutions. We're going to bring those, and the governments, our government especially, will be investing in the right areas, and a lot of entrepreneurial companies will be bringing great solutions to market. So I think it's a whole new market opportunity. I think that there's still going to be the great things to do in terms of new safe Facebook applications and software and things like that, but I think the bigger dollars are going to be here. I mean, you look at a lot of, when I was working in public accounting, we would help companies with their business plan, and they'd raise money, and they would talk about the market they were going into that was going to be a $15 billion market in 7 years, according to IDC or Forrester. Well, we're in a situation where Hurricane Sandy cost $150 billion just
wow.
That one event.
Michael,
so it's a big market.
I got to say, the time has gone all too quickly. I've been talking with Michael Torres. He is the CEO of Green World Restoration. Just got a big IDIQ award to work with the Texas General Land Office to rebuild homes destroyed in Texas regions impacted by natural disasters. And boy, as the weather situation and things continue to get crazier, Michael, I see a great future for your company. I want to thank you for being with us on Science News Network.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it. Have a wonderful day.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftoronto.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Well, the one lesson I try to teach my children that I learned long ago was it's relatively easy to do well do the things that you like to do well, but it takes real character to do the things that you don't like to do but have to do well. And that really distinguishes, I think, the people who are good at what they do from those who are excellent at what they do. Phil LaPlante, I am professor of software engineering at Penn State University in State College, Pennsylvania. I also chair the National Council of Examiners for Engineers and Surveyors, the committee that is developing the licensure examination for software engineers for the United States of America.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
You'll live tomorrow, 'cause you know it will be there. I am away. waiting for you. I am waiting for you. I